it's really impossible to go on with the neoliberal system, or even with the intensive system of extraction, manufacturing, and commercialization that we called Fordism, you know, mm-hmm. which, you know, there's two layers in the post-war period. There's the Fordist layer, and then there's the neoliberal layer. The neoliberal layer already sought to escape contradictions of the whole imperial construction, you know. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, it did so by globalization, by extension, by expansion, and by claiming to open up freedoms for people, yeah. Both freedoms to work, to create, to communicate, to express, even to be in a certain way, and then also formal freedoms before the law. All of that attempt to hold together the contradictions of this gigantic empire is now itself creating insurmountable contradictions, and I think it really points to the possibility of major change, and especially in the United States itself.
Yeah, and people who are active hope that it will lead to justice too.
Well, I mean, we're working on it, you know. I mean, but this is a view from the bottom of the hill, you know.
But is that the point, to get on top of the hill, or what do you mean exactly?
I think there's a million points. What people want is to achieve, you know, racial equity. I mean, because let's say it as it is, people are oppressed racially in the United States. Yeah. You know, they're oppressed by groups. At the same time, the problems that confront us all are also they're also international, and they're also ecological. So these conflicts on the ground between people who have been, you know, raced, who have been really pushed in to a social definition of who they are, and who have to struggle against that definition, against the conditions that substantiate it, all of that struggle is also, you know, it has been in the past the motor of industrial production, right? Struggle to get by, to improve yourself, and to get free of the conditions that you were in has also pushed the capitalist economy on. Mm-hmm. It's now pushing the capitalist economy into, well, over a cliff.
Yeah. Or is it just...
So we want to climb a hill, but we're also looking at falling off a cliff.
this imagery is good, but it goes all kinds, always, all different directions. But is it just you hoping that everything will collapse, or you really see it collapse?
No, I'm not hoping that it will collapse at all. I think that's a very foolish thing to hope for, and a waste of time. You know, what happens is not total collapse. What happens is decay.
Right.
We have experienced tremendous decay over these past 10 years, really tremendous since the financial crisis of 2008. And what we haven't experienced is any attempt to change the dynamic.
Right.
So now there's, you know, now there's a possibility. I don't know what it's like in Europe, but here there's both a real awareness. I mean, well, everywhere in the world, I mean, we are really hurting. These are bad times. Yeah. And no one can mistake that. I mean, there's been attempts to try to get around it, but it doesn't work, you know. So these are bad times, and yet it is exactly that finally makes people at different levels of society realize that something has to change. Now, saying like something has to change is pretty flat compared to what's happening. The ship is sinking. This is an emergency.
Yeah. But which ship is? I mean, the institutions of the United States. But how happy were you with these institutions in the first place?
Of course, I'm not happy with the institutions. But when you see the institutions start to break down,
yeah.
when you don't have alternatives for those institutions, because people have, you know, tried very hard to develop solidarities on the ground, But that does not replace the entire fabric of capitalist institutions that knits together everyday life. Mm-mm. And that can be that if it's possible to deal with that politically by using legislation and the law to change, you know, economic relations, I believe that's the only possibility, because you can't replace a form of organization on the scale of the United States and on the scale of globalization, you know, the globally interconnected economy. You can't replace it with purely localized arrangements unless you want to go through a true collapse. Right. With starvation, with war, yeah. With civil war. Yeah. That's, I don't want to go through such a collapse.
No, that's, of course, that's not what anybody wants. But yeah, okay. But we see threats of it. Like, for instance, Trump doesn't want to leave and says, "Well, maybe my people can save me or something." Or
seriously?
So, yeah, no, I mean,
yeah, there are very serious threats to it, I think.
Yeah. But that's not really happening, I think, now. But that's a thing that we can keep in mind for the future. Things like that could happen. So it looks pretty grim. Do you see things that have developed in a good way, or that you may not have expected to have happened last year, this year?
Well, I never. I mean, before the pandemic, you know, a lot has happened that I would never have expected. Mm. Before the pandemic, no one was taking seriously what a small number of people had nonetheless proposed, which we now call the Green New Deal.
Yeah.
No one was taking seriously the idea of creating and spending huge amounts of, you know, federally created money, mm-hmm. For transformative investment in energy infrastructure. This was not contemplated. Now it's contemplated all over the world, and that's an incredible tribute to ideas that came straight out of progressive left organizing, right? Mm-hmm. Progressive left green organizing.
Yeah.
And so this is something, you know, impressive. And if we could judge the next government by the best of the cabinet picks that have been made so far, then we would be looking at a kind of U.S. government that we have never seen in my lifetime. I mean, something more on the scale of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's administration than anything I've ever seen. But this all depends on how, you know, what kind of gridlock, what kind of paralysis comes next, or open conflict, depending on the way things go on January 6th.
Right. I think it's the third time we interview you on the radio, and each time I'm kind of, I don't have words to say back. I say, yeah, well, he's right, but I don't have a question like, so what's left to do? What can we do?
Well, I mean, we have everything to do. The thing that's really fascinating is that society is calling out for a change because so many things don't work. I mean, we have the clear demonstration that we have to work together. I mean, you can see that in the history of the pandemic here.
Yeah.
If you don't want a vaccine, then turn your back on the idea of social cooperation. If you want to get it in your arm, and if you want to see your neighbors get it, then something, there has to be a possibility, you know, to support a more integrated form of life, integrated in every sense, you know, integrated to in terms of human beings, in racial terms, in terms of ecological terms, and also integration between conduct of economics and the demands of life chances, you know, the demands of health. And so this, I think this is, for me, this is really interesting. I've always been, you know, an outsider, a revolutionary. Mm-hmm. And now I see that the chance for change is being presented to all of us. How do we seize it? I think we can, you know, I think we can seize it by becoming more oriented and more responsible in our not only personal, but also our professional and also our political lives. So all three of those things. And there was no chance of expecting this in this cynical, disabused, and complacent world of neoliberalism.
Yeah.
Now that we have an emergency, maybe, you know?
Yeah, I always thought, or have thought for the last couple of years, that whereas we're in a kind of a information war where people are kept confused and dumb by all kinds of media and social media, in fact, the internet has a great way of teaching people and kind of raising people and also kind of civilizing. And I also think that if, because there's so many people on the earth and everybody knows it, that people are less aggressive and more inclined to work together already. But this is not, you can't make money off it, so that's not really something that you read or see or listen to or you hear about. But it's happening nonetheless. That's what I think. So I'm a bit of an optimist, really. Do you think so too?
Well, that's brilliant to hear, you know, particularly at a moment where in the United States we have everybody, really at each other's necks with knives and pistols and all that, pushed on by the, you know, absurd use of communications technology, such as WhatsApp, for instance,
mm-hmm.
That you and I are communicating on now. I mean, this is you can't say it doesn't have to do with the technologies. Of course it does. It has to do with the social form of these technologies in our society today. Mm-hmm. I think that you know, the internet has been developed as a series of applications or affordances, as they say, you know. It's been developed by capitalist corporations.
Mm-hmm.
In operating, you know, capitalist corporations operating under the most iniquitous rules imaginable, you know, the rules of neoliberalism that only aim for the maximization of profit share, which is achieved today by capturing more and more of a person, by orienting them, by filling their mind, their heart, their desires, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And what's proved the strongest capture device in U.S. society is polarization. You know, hatred of the other.
Yeah, but it's so conflict we have, sells. I used to work in TV. You want conflict. That's good because people recognize a conflict. Some violence, that's good. It gets extra attention because violence is that's good for attention. So you have always too much violence and too much conflict. That's not really what's happening, but it's just enlarged always by the media because it sells and because it's attractive. So that gives you.
I think you're totally right, and I. So the question, I mean, whether we can, you know, whether we can experience as a reality the optimism that you just expressed and that I share, you know, is the question. You know, and this question is going to require that people find a way to reorient themselves from conflict and violence, because that road will just go on forever. I mean, you know, there's what we. Well, I think what we've seen is that it's a complex thing, you know. By stoking more conflict, we have revealed the intense problems of this society,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps this has happened in many societies. But by going further down the road of conflict and by allowing the communications tools to be used in this very short-sighted, profit-driven way, we will lose the chance to coordinate and to create this more integrated society that the times demand.
Mm. Yeah.
I guess maybe that's the central conflict, you know. And the way I see it is, can people, can individuals find a way to create, you know, not just productive outlets for their energy, but practices which create a more integral and beneficial social tie? This is the big question, because if this is not answered in the affirmative, if we can't do that, then we will do the opposite, which is to build, literally build protective enclaves in different ways, you know, using human resources, using technological resources, you know, whether it's guns, robots, identity cards, chips, whatever it takes. Mm. That would be the opposite of this more integrated, more beneficial, more healthy society.
Yeah. Okay, but this is all very abstract in my mind still. I want to quote someone, but I forgot his name. So I'm sorry. I'm not going to do it. If you want change, you have to want to give up things too, because you cannot have change and still keep everything you have. That's impossible. So that's one thing, and people are very afraid of losing what they have. So that's a thing that's also playing.
You make a fundamental point, and this is why I think that you know, the kind of belief that you can achieve a sort of a change on moral grounds. And I think we really should use the word moral, because mm-hmm. I think that's what it's about. I don't think it will work, you know. I think it has to be done on the grounds of a political economy, which does have to become a political ecology, you know. It has to take into account the things beyond human beings, but it has to have the kind of organization that we associate with political economy. And that organization isn't just an organization dictated by a state. It's also a set of conventions, rules, laws, operating procedures that allow people to work together. This is something that has remained, you know, has remained beyond the left, because we project utopian visions all the time, and we do so also with a moral charge that we're largely unaware of. Mm-hmm. But it's also it also has remained beyond the center, right? Beyond the right. They haven't been able to do it either, because they can't structure capitalism in a way that removes the incredibly damaging and conflict-producing elements that are central to capitalism.
Yeah.
I mean, inequality is central to capitalism. Right. You know, democracy demands equality. Capitalism demands inequality.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, the neoliberals tried to say inequality is good. It's the motor of progress, and it creates better outcomes. You know, bullshit. It's led us to this cliff, you know. It's led us where we're faced with this choice, you know. Do we take a viable path, or do we really let it decay? And so I think that there, you know, what I'm working on today is actually an art exhibition with the title Mapmaker, mm-hmm. There Is No Map, because that's what we're faced with. We have to deal with this map that we have, but we have to invent another one. And turn it into a reality. And if you want to get less abstract, I think we should. I think we should. I mean, it would be interesting to talk about. You've been talking with people about mutual aid, I imagine.
Yeah.
Can you say a little? What's your impressions?
Mutual aid. I haven't really been talking about mutual aid, but yeah, no. This will become. I have no plan. I have no idea of mutual aid. I was inspired by this book Bolo Bolo. I don't know if you know it, by PM.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yes, of course.
So that's one thing. Or the APP Day of Germany with their Balkanisierung, where they had people. like-minded people building states for themselves, where all the fascists would live in their little fascist province and leave all the others alone.
Well, it's an interesting idea, and maybe we'll get to that here in the United States. Yeah. You can come check it out. You know, can take a little trip in 10 years, you might be able to visit that place. But but what I see happening, you know, is something really interesting. I mean, people are actually creating in the United States mutual aid groups now.
Yeah.
And they are, because people don't have enough to eat in this country, man. Richest country in the world, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's 40% of the people don't have enough to eat.
Yeah, sick.
So what it turns out, I mean, it's insane.
Yeah. Well, we have what 17 million out? People in our tiny country. We have 17 million people. 1 million people live below poverty level now.
So yeah.
I mean, I know it's always more extreme in America, but it's very bad.
Yeah, and the difference in America is that it's a big place, and it's you know, America is a very chaotic and sprawling place. You know, we have state governments, we have local governments that you know, make a difference, but the state ones really make a huge difference. And so, you know, it will not be the cooperation of Bolo Bolo or of any sort of simple version of cooperation. What's rather happening, and what could grow, is the ability of communities to interface with larger organizations. You know, food is being distributed to people across Chicago, and I think across the United States, from production that can't be sold, right?
Yeah.
So you have the state, which buys this surplus or unsellable farm production. It's not like in the Grapes of Wrath. We don't see it thrown on the ground to rot, you know, and as in the famous passage from the Grapes of Wrath, where he looks at, you know, five different kinds of pears and plums that have been already genetically engineered, you know, to give riper fruits, but they can't sell them. Mm-mm. So they lie rotting on the ground. We don't see that in the United States today. What we see is, in fact, the government buying this food and making it available to local groups who self-organize to distribute it in a way that not only reaches the people who need it, but also reaches them through forms of social forms that they feel they can trust.
Yeah.
This is something really interesting.
Yeah,
this
absolutely.
Is interesting.
Yeah.
Because you have a blueprint or a sort of process diagram for a kind of mutual aid that wouldn't suffer from the fantasy of autarky,
mm-hmm.
you know, the idea that you're going to live off the garden that you grow, but also doesn't suffer from state or capitalist control at every level of experience.
So there's some hope, I hear.
Oh, yeah, there is. I mean, there is. And also, it must be said, I mean, people on the left don't say this, but so I'm going to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The government that has been elected and has, first of all, taken a stronger stance in favor of black people in particular and minorities in general than any previous government, including the fact of, you know, the composition of this government, who are the what you would call the ministers,
mm-hmm.
you know, the vice president and so on.
Yeah.
But it has also produced the most powerful, deep, transformative climate change agenda that has ever been developed in the United States.
Yeah.
And it's preparing to really free up money for that, you know,
mm-hmm.
Against in a struggle that you know, is a violent struggle, because what's being aimed at is so sweeping a transformation.
Mm.
We need that transformation, and I think this is going to be a very interesting 2021. I think there will be a lot of social struggle. Hopefully a lot of that struggle will be positive. I think there will be a large attempt to restructure the administration and what it's good for, you know, what we really think, where we really think we're going. I don't know if either of these things, either the efforts from the grassroots or the efforts from the top, are going to succeed, but they will try. And that will, you know, all, I mean, everyone who is not a reactionary is going to try to push for change. And that's going to make the upcoming year very interesting.
I think so too. Say, I would like to kind of close off because I want to call someone else also. Is there something you want to add to what you've said so far?
Well, I'm really curious about how people, you know, view not just what's this transformation in the United States is the beginning of transformations all around the world. It's happening in parallel, you know. Mm-hmm. We have the same rise of fascist elements all around the world. I really wonder how people see that, and I guess I would ask people to think about it. You spend a lot of time looking at the dramatic events in the United States. My belief, these events are happening in everyone's society.
Yeah.
And I think that the type of change that is coming to the world needs to be guided from every place, and particularly from the rich countries. And I would also say it needs to be guided from the middle classes of those countries.
Yeah.
Because if people think they can put all their faith in oppressed people, they're asking them not only to solve their own problems, but to solve our problems as well. And I speak as a person who is a middle-class person, white middle-class person.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that, of course, I know where I stand and in all of the struggles. That means I stand with oppressed minority groups because that's where these struggles come to violence. But if we look at the middle and the long term, it is everyone's responsibility to do something about this situation.
Right. Thank you very much.
Great talking with you, Menno. Have a great 2021. Eh?
Yes, you too.
Bye-bye now.
Hope to be calling you soon again.
Okay, wonderful speaking with you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Yeah, that was Brian Holmes uit Chicago. Die altijd een beetje somber kan zijn. Is Brian Holmes from Chicago. Who is pretty realistic. And in that way also not very optimistic. No, but he's not. So he's an optimist after all, we find out. The volgende, the next one we are going to call is of course Brian from Portland. Who hasn't tweeted for some time. So that's a thing.
Hello.
Hi, Brian. You're live in the broadcast again. So this is a kind of a roundup of 2020. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you now.
Okay. Oh, sorry. That's good. No, we're kind of looking back on the year 2020 of America and especially, activism, Black Lives Matter, and also this whole operation of getting Trump out of the White House, even though nobody really believes what Joe Biden says or means, but still have him elected, so the other one is gone. This is one big thing that happened, and I just want to think, can we look back a bit, or what's your impression of this? Because it was a big many people did a lot of things, and in the end Trump was away, and also Black Lives Matter is on the agenda. So what can you say about that?
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I think that on the one hand, sure, there's a lot of terrible things that happened this year, but I also wonder if there isn't a role of the connectivity of sort of social media and the internet and kind of the immediacy of communication that, you know, was both responsible for the good things that happened and the bad things, right? Or at least had some responsibility, right? Like, would we have seen this kind of mobilizations or these kind of nationwide and even eventually international kind of support for Black Lives Matter without the existence of the same sort of communication tools that led to, you know, the kinds of things that President Trump has been responsible for in terms of, you know, ginning up his base with kind of racism and dog whistles and, you know, kind of these violent outbursts. And then also, you know, if you look at kind of the things that happened with, most recently with the sort of bombing in Nashville, right? I mean, those things are not that different from a general year, right? So on the one hand, it seems like a big deal, you know, like this is the worst year ever and this kind of thing. On the other hand, you know, I think there's a lot of I guess I think there's a lot of good things that happened this year, you know. You know, this is the year that the country voted out Trump.
Yeah.
So that's certainly something. And this is the year that we've had kind of massive, as you've probably been talking about already, massive mobilizations for Black Lives Matter. And we've seen a lot of shifts in the discourse here in the United States around that.
Yeah. And also that the police is a kind of in the defensive in a way, that they are afraid to be defunded. And still we don't know what's coming, because we just spoke with Kali Akuno, and he says that I thought that maybe the police would be more careful and would have murdered or killed less minorities since right. George Floyd. But he says it's the opposite, that they got worse rather than better.
So that's what you were thinking, though. Yeah,
I was thinking that. I think that was when there's so much hassle over just someone who is killed, let's be more careful now. But they're not
right.
careful. So that's my naivete. Anyway, so no, that's not the case. But so that struggle is still to be fought out, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think we'll see. It's you know, it's the situation that it is, right? It's not going to change with one election. It's not going to change with 1 year of marches. It's going to take, a sustained effort. And I think that's, you know, we've been talking about that a little bit, you know, together over the last several weeks, right? Like, what happens next in Portland? You know, do the protesters figure out a way to, like, start doing real organizing? Do they start kind of digging deeper and, you know, figuring out, rather than waiting for the next big thing, right? You know, the next shooting, the next wildfires, the next, like, you know, disaster or major political issue. You know, do they instead start looking at how to, you know, as anarchists say, like, building dual power, right? Building the new world and the shell of the old and all of that. You know, it remains to be seen. I think that this is the big danger, right? Like, if we look at, you know, the 2008 here in the United States, right after Obama was elected, I think a lot of people would say that that's, you know, point to it. It's a time when kind of liberal or left politics just sort of went away, right? Just kind of like went on pause. It's like, okay, everything's cool. We've elected a black president. It's going to be great. The whole world is different. And, well, we can see where we've gone since then.
Yeah, that's one of the previous speakers said the same, that the last 10 years were, well, especially since the crisis of 2008, America has gone downhill in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that's also an economic thing, of course, that there are people getting rich, but that's just a few, and more aren't. So that's
right.
It's not good. But again, some other thing. I saw you haven't tweeted for some time.
Yeah, I'm kind of trying to take a break, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, partly it's just the holidays, right? So I've been spending time with my family and been kind of away from the computer, but also it's just been kind of, you know, it got real bad for a few days here in Portland within kind of the Twitter cancel culture, the whole sort of it started to feel like there wasn't much I could do, you know, that would be productive or constructive, and I didn't feel like I had a lot to say for the moment, shall we say. You know, I've been spending a bit of time thinking about the Arab Spring, you know, kind of hitting its 10th anniversary, and wondering if there's, you know, something I should be preparing or working on. I feel especially like come February 17th, you know, with the 10-year anniversary of the beginning of the Libyan Revolution, I kind of owe it to my friends and colleagues there, you know, the Libyan folks who I've worked with, and those folks that we've lost, to try to figure out something at least constructive, if not profound, to say about it, you know.
I've not much knowledge about the Libyan Revolution. I always thought it was kind of faked, a way to get Gaddafi out of the way, and then now you have this chaos. So it's and it was also NATO doing it. So it's all bad, I think. But I don't know. You were there.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, don't take this the wrong way, but I think that's kind of like a typical leftist impression about the revolution. Most Libyans that I know, you know, are able to hold the simultaneous opinion that, yes, things are bad now, but also we still believe that it was the right thing to do. Yeah. Right. And so I think that's something that's very difficult for Americans. You know, it's kind of like, and honestly, for anybody who's kind of from a more privileged circumstance, right?
Well, but I believe that. I can believe that it's good to get rid of him, like Gaddafi. But on the other side, you had this whole thing of the French who want to have him killed because he knew too much about people, and that side of the story, and
right.
This the eagerness of NATO to get to do it. I spoke to people who flew in AWACS, coordinating the attacks. So that's.
Mm-hmm.
Just a Dutch military guy, so I think even we were involved there. I think why would they? I mean, it's good for the people, but I don't. This military side, I don't know. But maybe you have.
I mean, I think that, like, you know, you can't expect anybody to like do so. I mean, would it be nice if people did things like entirely altruistically and without any like additional benefit or without any plan to try to find some other advantage? Sure, but like, I don't think that's particularly realistic, right? So on the one hand, you know, I do think that it was the right thing to put in a no-fly zone, and I do think that like the way that the thing started was the right thing to do. I also absolutely believe that, you know, the United States and Europe and, you know, NATO, as you said, took advantage where they could. And, you know, that's just, I mean, to me, that's just being like a mature, like, you know,
it's what,
you know,
do.
Eyes wide open kind of viewer at the world, right? Like, of course that's how it's going to happen. On the other hand, you know, as a journalist, being completely honest, like, I was in Benghazi on March 19th, and I've 100% believe that if it wasn't for
Yeah, I won't let love disrupt, corrupt, or interrupt me. enough for getting entre licores más amargos intento olvidarte, amor mío, pero es imposible porque estás dentro de mí. Día tras día lucho para arrancarte de mi alma. Entre cerveza y cerveza, entre cerveza y cerveza, pronuncio tu nombre, pronuncio tu nombre.
¡Vamos, vamos!
Oye, amigo cantinero, oye, amiga cantinera, dame dos cervezas para emborracharme.
Yeah. beats down and I lie on the bench. I can always hear them talk. Me? I'm just a lawnmower. You can tell me by the way I walk.
Blau. So böse stampfte mein nackter Fuß in